Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read with me, Professor Frances Ashcroft, where we discuss science books written for the general public. My guest today is Richard Boyd, Emeritus Professor of Physiology at the University of Oxford and an Emeritus Fellow of Brasenose College. Richard is a distinguished physiologist and an honorary fellow of the Physiological Society. He also happens to have a passion for birds. The book we're discussing is Cuckoo, Cheating by Nature by Nick Davis. The cuckoo is a ruthless parasite that lays its eggs in another bird's nest, tricks them into accepting the egg as its own, and entices them to feed its chick. Davis is Professor of Behavioural Ecology at the University of Cambridge and a great field naturalist. He's been studying how the cuckoo deceives its hosts and how the hosts fight back for over 30 years. The book is a riveting account of an extraordinary bird, and it reads like a nature detective story. David asks every question you could possibly imagine about how the female cuckoo and the cuckoo chick managed to deceive their host. And he then describes the intricate experiments he and his colleagues have conducted to unravel the answers. He interweaves this with stories of naturalists from the past who have studied the cuckoo. He writes beautifully, and his passion for the cuckoo and the natural world shines through. I found it a truly wonderful book. Richard, what did you think?
Well, I read the book because friends in Cambridge told me there was this terrific person who'd written a book on the cuckoo, and they were right. I was entranced by it. And I've reread it, obviously, before this episode, and I'm still entranced by it. I think the quality of the writing that you've mentioned, Fran, is very definitely there, but so the illustrations, the line drawings, and the historical thread through it. But more than that, there's a lot of interest between where science ends and nature study begins and vice versa. That interplay comes through very, very, very well. It's rooted in a place, Wicken Fen, near Cambridge, and that gave me a lot of satisfaction because I remember Wicken Fen from my childhood. But more than that, it also has 500 years of little bits of history coming through with all the personalities. A lovely book.
Yes, the cuckoo parasitizes the reed warblers in Wicken Fen, and the way he describes this is just simply lyrical, really. It's an entrancing book. And it follows a story of the cuckoo from the arrival of the adults in early summer to the departure of the chicks for Africa. And there are some astonishing insights at every stage, I thought. I mean, I was fascinated by how quickly the cuckoo lays her egg. It's all over in 9 seconds. Flies down to the nest, takes out an egg that's already there, and either swallows it or drops it or destroys it in some way and lays her own in just 9 seconds.
Wonderful. And of course, like all bits of biology, there's the behavioural aspect, which is intriguing, but there's also the mechanics. What's happening in the oviduct? Where is this egg? How long has it been there? What are the triggers for making it propelled into the egg of the poor reed warbler that's going to look after it? And I think there are some very interesting questions that I come from the more reductive end of science intrigue me, like where's the sperm kept? What's it doing with all these glands to store that, as well as the way the egg's kept? And then, of course, the formation of the egg.
I didn't realise that it's actually quite a quick business laying an egg. It takes about a day to produce an egg. And that's what the reed warbler does. So it lays its egg, and then the cuckoo comes down and lays its egg. But the cuckoo's egg is older because the cuckoo retains the egg in the oviduct for 2 days instead of one, which is quite extraordinary.
And it gives the young chick a bit of a head start because it's already started its development before it appears in the outside world.
It does indeed. And I think the other thing I was fascinated about the whole process of laying of the egg is how the cuckoo chooses the nest. It has to know when to lay the egg. It has to watch the reed warbler for a long time, and it has to be able to have a perch close by to the nest. So if the reed warblers are clever, they build away from any place that a cuckoo could possibly perch.
Funnily enough, I remember beautifully in not Wicken Fen, but Otmoor near Oxford, seeing exactly that, the cuckoo on a small oak tree, looking at the reed bed in there in a flash. And then 3 weeks later, going there, and there was the young cuckoo from that same spot. So that I do feel, although I'm absolutely not a professional ornithologist anyway, I do recognise what Davies describes so beautifully.
I would love to have seen that. I've never seen that. I've seen cuckoos, but never seen a baby cuckoo. So I suppose the next question is, how does the cuckoo deceive the reed warbler into retaining the egg and accepting it as one of its own?
So this is beautifully described by Davies, and he's been working on this for a lifetime, really. And there are multiple levels of deception, and then there are multiple levels of trying to counter the deceptions from each side. You get what he calls an arms race, and I think it's a very good expression, because actually we all know across biology organisms are interacting in a competitive way, but particularly dramatically. So a way in which the eggs are decorated, the formation of the egg we've already mentioned, but actually its colouring and the patterns on it and what's the background tone, all of those turn out to be things that evolution has sculpted for the cuckoo predating, as it were, on a particular species nest.
Yes, and he describes beautifully the experiments that he does. For example, he plays at being the cuckoo and takes out one of the host eggs and replaces it with one that he's made himself, which also is quite extraordinary that he was able to deceive the cuckoo. And they tried eggs of different sizes and different colours, and from that they discovered that there are different sort of cuckoo varieties which parasitise different types of birds and match their eggs exactly to the host.
Fran, I'm very interested you use the word varieties, because that's a totally appropriate word. I noticed that in this he intermittently uses the word race, which has all sorts of interesting connotations to human beings, but then that gets on to where the subspecies come in the cuckoos. And I think, therefore, we're into the evolution of things that Darwin was interested in also, as we look at these different varieties of the cuckoo species. And they even are different colours. The cuckoo, the adult cuckoo female, may be its more common form of the grey one with its barred belly, but it may be rufous. And all of these turn out to be part of the way in which the cuckoo tries to confuse and negate the effects of the reed warbling or other birds that are being used by the cuckoo to bring up their young, the brood parasitism.
One of the things that the cuckoo does, in addition to matching the colour of the eggs, is also to match the patterns, the markings on the eggs. And he describes this very beautifully, and how there's a sort of evolutionary arms race between the cuckoo and its host, with the cuckoo matching the egg, but then the host, making it even more complicated. So the cuckoo then has to evolve even further. And you can see this at all different stages if you look across the different cuckoo species or the different varieties of cuckoo which parasitise different birds.
So picking up on that, Fran, I think the two things that struck me very forcibly, what you're saying about the coloration and the subtlety of that, and yet at the end of this cuckoo egg hatching, you're presented with this chick that ends up being six times heavier than the poor adult bird that's trying to keep it going. And the eggs are recognised by the host as being odd unless the cuckoo gets it right. Yet the chick, even when it's six times bigger than the adult, is not rejected. So there are clearly things that seem to us very subtle. There are other things that seem to us very odd. How is it that a tiny reed warbler can feed this monster as it as it emerges into adulthood? I think that is fun. The other bit, just to touch on where the physiology is intriguing to me, is the ability of the young bird to eject the eggs of the native bird in its nest, or the young when they're hatched. And it has this incredibly strong drive. They describe it as an instinct. I'd see it really as a set of reflex responses to eject from the nest everything that's in there apart from looking after itself. And it does that by using its back to heave the thing out over the edge of the nest. It's the most remarkable bit of physiology.
There's a wonderful description of that, of course, in a paper that was published by the Royal Society by Edward Jenner, wasn't there? You imagine Jenner really as being the person who first used vaccination. That's what we revere him for. But also he was a cuckoo watcher.
He was indeed, and there's this wonderful description that he gave to the Royal Society, and the president of the Royal Society subsequently thought that this was likely to be extremely incorrect, invented by Jenner, and he arranged for the publication to be delayed so that Dr. Jenner could take time to change his mind. Actually, Jenner was right, and he went on subsequently to the story of vaccination, which is, you know, one of the world's most important discoveries in a way. But I think if you're an ornithologist or inclined that way, the other discovery is pretty neat too.
Yes, yeah. I totally agree. And it is amazing that the chick knows it has to do this.
So Davis, I think, is quite subtle in distinguishing between losing the eggs, if you're a reed warbler, when you can replace them, but losing young, you can't replace them because it's too far into the breeding season. So you've lost that years of chance to reproduce. A number of eggs that a cuckoo can lay was something I'd never thought about. And of course, because the cuckoo's not having to produce full food to feed any young, it actually is able to use its protein metabolism to produce eggs very effectively. And a female cuckoo can lay 30 or more eggs, which is many, many more times than a reed warbler could ever produce.
Yes, it's pretty amazing. So you look at it, there is this sort of, as I said, or he says, this evolutionary arms race between the two of them, with the cuckoo trying to deceive the host, and then the host bird developing counter strategies in order to, defeat them. He describes rather well what these things are, certainly at the egg stage. First of all, that the host rejects eggs that are different in size or colour, or these signature patterns that are on them, and that it watches out for cuckoos in the vicinity to determine the risk that it might be parasitised, which is why the cuckoo has to be so secretive and has to be so patient watching for the reed warbler. And actually, I was fascinated by that because I realise that you have to be a very patient person to sit and watch the cuckoo lay its egg. But actually, the cuckoo itself has to be incredibly patient, doesn't it?
And it's very interesting. That's the female cuckoo that's very secretive, very briefly at the nest. The male cuckoo, of course, goes around strutting its stuff all through the 8 weeks that it's here by its song and sound and so forth. So you're dead right. The strategy of the female is extremely impressive and observant.
Isn't that always the case with men and women?
Thank you, Fran.
And then, of course, the hosts have to attack the female cuckoos to deter them from laying. And that's why, that was also another interesting thing. I always thought that they looked like hawks, but it turns out that this is an evolutionary strategy to sort of outwit the reed warbler, because they they tend to be rather shy and fly away when they see a hawk.
And Davis does lovely experiments that shows that. I think that's a very good example of doing a very simple conceptually experiment, which is done very deftly in this work, that the hawk-like nature of the cuckoo is very definitely part of its strategy.
Yes, so he takes, basically taxidermy specimens, doesn't he, and sits them by the nest to see how often that they're attacked. And then he makes them look like a cuckoo instead of more like a hawk. It's really fascinating.
And that bringing these points together, Fran, it's the integration of all these signals that end up determining the reed warbler's response, whether it does or doesn't reject the egg. And that struck me as being rather nice. Again, as a physiologist, one knows about integration of signals in the spinal cord, as discovered by Sherrington. Clearly, that sort of integration must be going on in biology across the board when you deal with behavioural aspects of the field that Davis is describing. I think the word integration is very powerful.
I was fascinated by the way that Davis comes up with lots of questions that I hadn't actually thought of. Because you can think about how the reed warbler decides that it isn't going to accept an egg. It doesn't match somehow. But it's actually much more complicated than that, because once it's decided that it isn't quite right, how does it know whether it should eject it? And it's got various things that it really needs to know, doesn't it? How does it know what its own egg looks like? That's one thing that Davis describes in some detail. And the other one is, how does it know that this one is sufficiently different to not be its own egg or to be a cuckoo's egg? Because after all, there is variation in the eggs that the reed warbler itself lays.
It's really nearly a question of probabilities. At what point for the reed warbler is it worth taking the gamble that it might be its own versus it might be parasitised by the cuckoo?
Exactly.
And that, I think, is a very interesting aspect. And it's individuals then overlapping with sort of population biology.
And I want to read a little bit now, because it isn't all about egg laying and choosing which egg it is. There's this wonderful paragraph that Davis writes. He says, "Spare a thought for the reed warblers. Your arch enemy sometimes appears hawk-like, but is sometimes very different in its dress." That's the rufous and the grey forms you've described. "It is secretive and incredibly quick when it invades your territory, and it appears to leave no trace, no change in the number of eggs in the nest, nor in their appearance. You incubate the clutch, and then something extraordinary happens. One of the chicks throws all the other eggs out of the nest and grows to 8 times your own body weight. At last, surely, you will realise you've been duped." And it doesn't. That's the remarkable thing. It doesn't.
And that, again, Reeves, I love the way you say he thinks of questions that, as a naive reader, I wouldn't have thought of. But what it turns out here is seriously interesting is the rate of making cheeping noises of the young.
Yes, that was fascinating, wasn't it? It was something I'd never thought about. So obviously the cuckoo is so much bigger than a reed warbler chick that it requires a lot more food, and it has to persuade the reed warblers hosts, the foster parents, to continue to bring lots of food. So it makes the noise that sounds like a whole brood of chicks that are there.
No, brilliant, isn't it? Wonderful. And the mimicry that's involved in that, and then they basically want to take the incubation period or the period of being fed in the nest a bit longer, and at some point the reed warblers are getting a bit nervous about that, and then it's out on the open world, again, requiring food for another couple of weeks, and somehow it's got to carry on this all the way through. It's a very dramatic story.
What do you think was the most surprising thing you learnt?
I read the book first time and got a little bit switched off by hearing about what happened in Australian cuckoos or so on and so forth. But in fact, when I reread it the second time, I thought, absolutely fascinating. Look at the panoply of evolutionary biology with this general problem of, for example, cuckoos across the world. The common cuckoo, which this book is basically about, occupies about 40% of the land surface of the world, but there are plenty of others, and particularly in Africa, you've got an extraordinary panoply of cuckoo-like behaviour of other small cuckoo family-related birds, and all of those have very fascinating strategies that are subtly different. So this is an example of one of a great range of activities that allow organisms to exploit each other.
Yes, I agree. That was fascinating. But for me, the most surprising thing was something you probably already knew. It's only the male bird that goes cuckoo. The female has a totally different cry. He describes it as a sort of chuckling. I had no idea. So I don't think I've ever heard a female cuckoo. And another question I wondered is, why do you think it is then, given that it's a parasite, that the cuckoo's so celebrated in folklore and poetry and music?
No, it's fascinating, that, isn't it? I think the word cuckold, if I've pronouncing it right, is quite interesting, because that takes you into sexual sociology, and human beings are quite strong on that. But I think
so. You think it's because, you know, we approve of cheating?
Cheating by nature, Fran.
Cunning.
No, I mean, there's no doubt at all. It's a fascinating example of cheating, but he also makes the point that it is remarkable that it's only about 1% of birds that have this sort of behaviour, although a lot of other species do it occasionally, like the moorhen, which he again has a little digression into, which I found very interesting. But the fully flown form of being an obligate brood parasite, I think, is absolutely fascinating as being what the cuckoo represents. And yet, Fran, as you know and I know, the number of cuckoos you'll hear this spring and summer will be fewer than you would have had in your childhood.
I was going to ask you about that. Mm. You've noticed the decline.
Yes, absolutely.
So yes. Have I. And yes. It's incredibly sad, and it's something that he ends the book with, isn't it?
Yep.
He said 24% of reed warblers were parasitized what was it, 1985
exactly.
or something?
Yes, exactly.
And just 1% in 2012.
Yes. Yeah.
That's an extraordinary reduction.
So can we feel sorry for the reed warblers or for the cuckoo or for biodiversity?
For biodiversity.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And also for ourselves, because I think it is one of the most wonderful things in early summer, or late spring, early summer, I think, to hear the cuckoo.
Yeah,
and it was the sound of my childhood.
Fran, I do remember, because I'm old enough to remember, writing myself a little diary about birds when I was growing up, and there suddenly, in the middle of April, in whenever it was, first man in space, first cuckoo of spring. I heard them both on the same morning. And, you know, I'd love to feel that generations to come can have the same excitement of hearing the first cuckoo of spring.
I totally agree. So let's hope that we can save the cuckoo and that it continues to delight us as a harbinger of summer. But that's all we have time for today. So thank you to my guest, Richard Boyd from the University of Oxford. The book we've been discussing is Cuckoo, Cheating by Nature by Nick Davis, published by Bloomsbury Press in 2015. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.